So I felt like, you know, I think you probably feel like that's okay, that last night at the end you're kind of lost in the weeds, like, you know, we're talking about letters to Christmas, to Olympias and despondency, and then we spent like an hour talking about virtue, and I don't really know why that was, okay? So it was part of the plan, not to lose you, but to talk about virtue. So so let's go back, not to the background. You remember everything about Olympias and St. John and his exile, and what led all this to these letters was her despondency, right? So to talk about her despondency, her hopelessness, her despair, which the Father says is the worst possible passion, because it's basically just like a paralysis, yeah. Spiritual paralysis. When you're hopeless, you just don't want to do anything. Why try? So he's writing these letters to her. So, you know, the key is this. Go back, just a quick review. The very first thing I said was what? Everything, not everything, have to hurry. God is in control. Right? God is in control. So that means, as we often hear, maybe we've even said it, everything happens for a reason. But unfortunately, when people say that, we've maybe even done it, we kind of just mean it sort of lightly, you know, look on the bright side. Everything happens for a reason, right? I lost this job, I'm going to get another job, right? And I said that that's, you know, that's okay, but it's really not what we mean when we talk about God is in control. We mean that God's reason, when God's in control, means that everything that happens, no matter what happens, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and believing that everything that God is in control doesn't mean that the ugly and the bad don't happen. They happen. I mean, St. John going into exile, it's not good. We're not feeling like it's a good thing, right? This isn't about that. You're up, you know. It's not just be chipper and try to, you know, tough it out. But it means that everything happens for a reason. But, here's the big but. P.B. Herman said, what, everybody's got a big but, right? Sorry. I had to meet you. Here's the big but. Everything happens for a reason, but God's reason is our salvation. Right? So the reason things happen is not just some sort of everything happens for a reason. The reason is our salvation. And this is where we got to virtue. And maybe we got lost talking about virtue, right? But it doesn't just mean this has happened so I'm going to be saved, kind of somehow some magical transfer. I'm experiencing suffering so that when I die, I'll just automatically go to heaven. No, no, no. St. John says to Olympias, and repeatedly, that how we're saved, right? If everything happens for my salvation, how I'm saved is I have to turn things into my salvation. And that's where the virtue is really, really important, okay? That we understand that virtue is the first phase on the path to salvation. It's the first stage of, you know, if you want to use the big words, deification, theosis. It's the very first stage. And virtue, as I tried to mention last night, probably didn't say it strongly enough. Virtue really is about keeping the commandments of Christ. When we keep the commandments of Christ, and Christ is hidden in his commandments, then we discover Christ in the commandment. We keep the commandment, and ta-da, it's not just an obligation or a rule or some sort of heavenly thou shalt issued from on high, so like, okay, I shout, I guess. It's actually God himself. The icon is a verbal icon of Christ. A verbal icon of Christ. That's what the commandment is. The commandment of Christ. So when we keep the commandment, we discover Christ. So this is why the whole virtue thing is important. Because if we don't understand that, and we say everything happened for my salvation, we can just turn that into bad things are happening, but I guess it's for my salvation. Woe is me, but I'll get to go to heaven eventually. That's not what we're saying. It takes more effort than that, unfortunately. It'd be fine if we just said I'm suffering this life and then the next life I won't or some such thing. But salvation isn't automatic. Suffering isn't automatic. Suffering can be a great thing for your salvation, but it's not automatic. It can also destroy you. Right? Olympias is desponding. She's not saying, woohoo, I'm going to be saved. She's saying, why is all this happening? I've given my life, my wealth, everything. I didn't remarry. Right? Husband's dead after 2 years. No children. I'm not going to remarry. I'm going to give my whole life to God and the church. And then this happens. Right? Suffering isn't automatic. It's hidden. Right? So she has to find the way through it. How do you do that? Okay? So, that's the recap. I hope that's helpful. Brings it up to this point. So all the talk about virtue might seem like a rabbit trail or a detour, but it's essential to understanding St. John's guidance to Olympias. And this is why. Okay, this is why the virtue talk is also important. Because we cannot control our external circumstances. Hardly at all. If you think you're in control, you're mostly deluding yourself. And if you are married or have children or are basically alive and past the age of, I don't know, 25, that's all it takes. A little bit of suffering and or one small child or marrying a man. I mean, you think you're in control. You're not. You're not in control of anybody else. I mean, I hear a lot of confessions, and a lot of mothers come to me and like, oh, my child is in this and that, and I can't change him and make him stop. It's like, yeah, I know. Guess what? You can't. All you can do is offer guidance and love them, and if they're young enough, discipline them, you know, with good discipline, all that stuff. But you know, if you've had a child, from the time they're about that age, their personality is largely set. I mean, I have mothers of 15-year-olds come to me and say, oh, my child's doing this, and I wish he wasn't this way. I'm like, he is this way. That ain't going to change now. You can try to help him learn virtue. Excellent. But trying to, like, change his personality. I mean, forget 15 by the time he's 5. You're not going to. You're just beating your head against the wall. So we're really not in control of very much. So if we think the spiritual life is about getting control of this, we're setting ourselves up completely for despondency. So the virtue, this is why it's so important, that's the thing we can control. That's the only thing we can control. Not what happens to us, not what happens all around us, and even what happens with us. I mean, you know, you get cancer, you didn't choose that. But it's happening to you, it's in your very body, right? Or maybe even certain dispositions of your soul. Maybe the fact that you're, you know, the child of someone who was had a narcissistic personality disorder. You're going to struggle with that your whole life. If your mother or father was a narcissist, you're going to struggle with that your whole life. I'm not a psychologist, I'm not even trying to talk like one. I'm just telling you, this is something you struggle with. You don't have any control over who your parents were. You don't have any control over who your children are. I mean, past and future. I mean, you got very little control. So, we cannot control our circumstances. And we have little to no control over what happens in the church. Again, clergy, wives, and priests. How much control over the church do you have? I mean, not only the church, the global church. I'm talking about your parish. Do you get to decide which man in the church gets mad at your husband for this or that or the other, or which woman in the church gets mad at you or your husband? You have very little control over that. People sometimes just go crazy. I mean, I'm seriously. Sometimes it's us, but I mean, sometimes our Christians just go crazy. You know, I've got a situation, I don't want to talk too personal, but I mean, I've got people, you know, I've got people in our church that just go crazy. Or they just drop out. People that are very involved in church, like readers, singers, that just sort of all of a sudden, boom, they're gone. I don't have any control over that. Right? So, we have very little control over these things. The only thing we can really control, then, is what we do in the situation. Right? I mean, it seems very obvious. It's actually quite obvious. It's actually a truism. You can only control what you can control. I mean, to say it very sort of simply. But we forget it so very easily. Right? So, our work, and this is what Chrysostom is telling Olympias. This is why virtue is so important. Our work, our attention, our focus needs to be on the only things that we can control. Not what happens around us, or, you know, with other people around us. Even the people, Olympias just loves Chrysostom, her spiritual father. She just devoted to him. She has no control over what happened to him. Right? When we make our focus on these things that we cannot control, and we make our, give them our attention and our energy and our focus, and try to control them,
really, really bad things happen. Okay, I heard the story of this Chinese farmer. He's very poor. He's basically like what the Russians would have called a serf. So he lives on the land. He's got really nothing. He's got one horse. That's like his estate is this horse. So one day his horse runs off. And all the neighbors come running to his house and say, "Oh, your horse ran off. It's so terrible." And the farmer says, "Maybe, maybe not. We'll see." And the neighbors are stretching their legs. He just lost his horse. I mean, what do you mean, maybe, maybe not? The next day, the horse comes back and brings with him a whole herd of wild horses. So he's got this whole, like, herd of horses. And the neighbors come running. "This is fantastic. You now have all these horses. Isn't this fantastic? Isn't this great?" He says, "Maybe, maybe not. We'll see." The next day, his son gets on one of the wild horses to try to break it and falls off and breaks his leg. So he broke his leg. He can't work in the field. And the neighbors come running and say, "This is terrible." You know, you get it? Yeah. "Maybe, maybe not. We'll see." And they just still can't understand the farmer. The next day, the army comes through and they're conscripting young men into the service to go fight a battle. And the son can't go because his leg's broken. Right? You get it. And we could go day after day. That's as far as the story goes as I've heard it, right? But the point is, what? The people of the village, they're like most of us. They're making judgments all the time, and this is what we do. And this is what gets us into almost all of our trouble. We're constantly making judgments on everything that's happening around us and outside of us. This is good. That's bad. That's awful. That's great. And what are we doing when we do that? When we're making a judgment? It's not just a judgment, and that's exactly what it is. We're making a decision. That's a judgment. What's good, you know, this is good, this is bad. But when we make a decision like this, when we make a judgment, we're in effect enslaving ourselves to that event now. This is good. Oh, so now my happiness is based upon this being good. Right? This is great. But now I'm connected to this thing. I've enslaved myself to it. My happiness is now contingent upon this thing that's happened. And what about when the bad thing then happens? What happens when the horse runs away? I've got a horse. Yay. My horse ran away. So this becomes my life. And it's all outside of me. It's nothing I can even control. My whole life becomes this. Up and down, up and down, up and down. Elated, despondent. Elated, despondent. Right? Is that the kind of peace that the fathers and mothers of the church are talking about? No. It's not even what the fathers and mothers of the church talk about sobriety. They're not even really talking about alcohol. They're talking about spiritual sobriety. Right? But this sort of sobriety is this sort of kind of even keel. Maybe, maybe not. We'll see. Right? So, what Chrysostom says to Olympius is, in whatever our circumstances and our situation, our focus must simply be on keeping the commandments of Christ. Not on trying to control our external situation or tying our happiness or our spiritual condition or anything to those external things. If we get this wrong, yeah.
Okay, so we're supposed to focus on keeping the commandments and not assigning value to these different events.
Right.
Like in your scenario with the horse, could you give me an example of what that might look like?
I mean, bad things happen in our life all the time. You know, parish stuff. You got someone in the parish, you know that you need every, you know, person in that parish, or mission in my case, to keep the thing running. And if you lose a parishioner, job transfer, they lose a job, or they just get mad at you and leave, or go back to what we call, when people join the church, their former delusion, right? But people do this all the time, congregants all the time, past, come in the front door of the other church and go out the back door. And we set our hope on this. Look at this new family. This is amazing. And look, they're tigers. This is fantastic. And there you go. So I'm so excited, new people. I'm so dejected. I've lost people, right? This happens all the time.
Right.
Right? Faithful parishioners who just sort of bottom out, you know. People just, you all know this, they burn out. And they say, I just can't do anymore. Maybe they actually quit the church, or maybe they just say, I can no longer read. And that seems like a small thing, but when you're looking for a reader, you've got one and he stops. Right? So it's a small thing. But it can be the big stuff. You know, a major family in your parish goes through a divorce. You know? Maybe godparents of your children or something. I mean, these things happen all the time. They're not strange to any of us. But, you know, so, and I don't want to get ahead because we're going to talk about some of this. So Kristen will tell Olympias, we'll talk about this at the end, it's okay to grieve these things. We're not talking about stoic coldness. These things are happening, I don't care, it doesn't even bother me. We're not Spock, we're not supposed to be. Right? For you sci-fi people, I'm not a sci-fi guy, but right. I know some of your kids would enjoy that word. But we're not supposed to be Spock. I mean, it's not passionlessness or apatheia in the Orthodox tradition isn't coldness. Right? So, and he doesn't recommend to Olympias not to grieve over the things that are happening. Right? But he does say, don't grieve excessively. Right? And sometimes I appreciate what he says, but it could be said another way, although now that I think about it, I don't know how I would say it better. But sometimes when we put things in degrees, like do this, but don't do it this much, we have a hard time finding where that is. Right? But he's saying it's okay to be sad. It's okay to be sad. Bad things happen. People get divorced. People leave the church. People die. Bad things happen. We're not ignoring that. But if my stability, I mean, forget happiness, even just maybe my psychological stability, I'm keeping it together because these people are here and they're tithing and we're, right? You know, but we can put our hopes on a lot of things. And if like, it's like playing Jenga, but what about when someone pulls that one out and the thing tumbles? If my life is this Jenga thing, I'm in trouble. If that's my emotional, spiritual, psychological stability, just keeping this tower up and don't take it up and don't take it up, then I'm in real trouble. I don't know if that helps or not. So these kind of things happen all the time. And if we get this wrong, if our focus becomes on these things, our happiness and our stability and everything else, becomes on these things outside of us, then trouble follows. Either, a couple things happens. I've only listed two, but there might be 27 for all I know. Either one of two things happens. Either, because what we're trying to do is sort of control the world. Trying to keep it all together by the force of our will. It's, you know, white knuckle spirituality, I call it. Right? People talk about this in 12-step groups. White knuckle sobriety. I quit drinking, but they never really go beyond I'm just not drinking, and they become what they call dry drunks. Right? And you can do this in spirituality too. In the church and religious life, it's not just alcohol or something. You can just sort of like, I'm getting through, right? We all have moments like that, but your whole life can't be like that. You can't endure it for very long. You can't take it for very long. So, when this happens, a couple of things happens. Either we use religion to try to control God. Because, see, what we're doing is we're trying to control everything, right? So then we become like the people in the gospel. I won't give this morning's sermon again, don't worry. I won't even give a second sermon on that same gospel. But, in effect, what religious professionals try to do is use religion to control God. Right? It's not just like, this is my life, I'm a priest, but I'm now using it to try to control God. God, I gave you my life, and you can see Olympias doing this. Right? I gave you my life, I gave you my fortune, I didn't marry you, I did all these things, and this is what happens, and we sort of like try to control God. It's like this massive quid pro quo. God, I'm going to do all of this, but, man, there's always a big but. You're going to do this. You're going to keep my kids healthy. You're going to keep them in the church. You're going to keep them, they're going to marry Orthodox Christians. We've got all these sort of things. You're like, guess what? But that doesn't happen. You know, you use religion to try to control God and bad things happen. In effect, this is, by the way, this is what pagan religion is. Paganism is one big sort of organized way of trying to sort of continue to do this deal with the gods all the time. We need rain. We need rain for these crops, so let's do this and this and this to, you know, to get it. And too much Christianity is just, forgive me, it's just sort of like a Trinitarian form of paganism. I mean, I've never said that before. It sounds blasphemous to even say it. But we too often live this way. This quid pro quos and doing deals with God, and, you know, we know we've got the training, we've got the right God, but we're still living, you know, in here so often like pagans. We're just sort of trying to keep on God's good side so that He'll give us, you know, the healthy kids, the kids in the church, the kids, you know, who don't abandon the faith, the parish, the parishioners who don't go crazy, etc. So that's one thing that happens. If we're trying to control everything, we try to control God, and we use religion to try to do that. That's one possibility. And the other one, and it's not even, these aren't like possibilities, you can do both of these. We can just try to control other people and other situations. And we know what this looks like, if we're honest. This is manipulation, right? Emotional, financial, spiritual, right? Manipulation. Trying to control other people because we want to be in control of the situation. We tell ourselves our motives are great. We want this church to hang together. I want my family to hang together. So it's okay to, you know, use some guilt and to manipulate a little bit and to do this and that because we need this to stay together. And what we're really not being honest with ourselves about is I need it all to stay together. This really isn't about the church. This isn't even, let's be honest sometimes, this isn't even about my family. I just need control. Because what will happen if there's not control? What happens if it all falls apart? We can't like the king and imagine that, so we just go to work controlling, trying to control God, trying to control other people, even the people we love the most. And we know, honestly, we know it's toxic. And our whole, by the way, our whole society does this. I mean, not to even open this, but just to say it. I mean, what is all of our technology? And I've got an iPhone too. I drove here in a car. I mean, I'm not a Luddite. I like to be a baby, but what is so much of our technology now except just an attempt to control? I mean, even you can just even read the history of technology, and you know, we need to control nature. That was sort of the driving thing. This nature's crazy. I mean, storms and diseases and plagues and Spanish flu. We need to take control of this. And we now can with our science. And so it's all this sort of desire, right? We're still listening to the serpent who says, you can be as God, right? Go back and read the opening chapters of the book, and it's the serpent saying, you can be as God without God. And a few chapters later, they're building a tower to storm heaven, right? We're going to make a name for ourselves. It's really all about control. And so when we do all of these things, whether it's religion or whether it's manipulation or whether it's in our parishes or whether it's in our family, and we've done all this stuff and all this sacrifice, this quid pro quo, God, we've given everything, we've given our whole lives. I didn't become a doctor like some other guy did to make millions of dollars. I'm a priest. I'm double digits here. Well, I'm not even in triple digits, right? All these things you've given up and, you know, priest and clergy wife, deacon wife can say this same sort of thing, right? We try to control, and when all fails, what happens? When it all comes down like that Jenga house or the house of cards, despondency. Because our whole focus is then on all this external stuff. All these things that we never had control over in the first place. We just told ourselves we did. So at the root of this, you know, this compulsion to be in control, obviously, is fear. And fear is like the ultimate enemy of faith for a couple of reasons. First of all, obviously, fear, again, this is just sort of a tautology. Fear takes our eyes off of God and puts them on all these other things. Right? I see these things happening. I mean, think of Peter. Lord, let me come to you on the waves. Jesus walking on the water, let me come to you. As long as he's looking at Jesus, he's fine. As soon as he looks away, he starts looking at the waves and the wind and, oh, look at what's going on. What am I doing out here? He starts to sing. Right, we know that. So fear is like acid to faith. It's just corrosive. But it's what motivates so much of what we do. Secondly, fear generates, and St. John Chrysostom talks about this in the letters to Olympias. This is really ironic. Fear generates fantasies. Right? We get afraid of something. We get afraid of a situation. And then we start to imagine what's going to happen as a result of all this. Right? I mean, just think of someone who's become, my brain's failing. What's it when you're afraid of diseases?
Hypochondria.
Right? Start. She's not here. My daughter's a little bit this way. If she sees on a TV show that someone has something, she's 16, she'll come and ask me, Dad, can you get, I don't remember what the most recent one was. She's terrified of appendicitis for some reason. I mean, terrified of little stuff. And I just have to tease her. Honestly, I mean, I'm not as cold as that sounds. But I mean, I just kind of have to jar her out of it. It's like, right? But I don't want to rabbit trail, but forgive me. Like, even with our kids, we have to sort of do this. This need to be in control. You know, you've all probably had your kids come to you at some point and say, Mom, can this happen to me? And I think personally, I'm not some sort of family guidance guy. But I think the worst thing you can say is, no, that won't happen to you. Because it might be. So what I've always told my kids, quite honestly, yeah, that could happen to you. And just kind of let them sit with that for a second and then watch them sort of shake and shiver and begin to fear. And I mean, maybe it's brutal, I don't know, but even they're pretty young, they're like, yeah, that could happen to you. What kind of person are you going to be to meet that if it happens? But telling them, no, that's not going to happen to you. You're never going to be hit by a car. You're never going to have a heart attack. You're never going to get cancer. Really? I mean, you brought a child to this world. Things are going to happen to them. So, you know, we've got really no business telling people all of those things won't happen to you. But what happens is when we start to fear, then fear starts to create all sorts of fantasies. We tend to think fantasies now like just about sex, but the Greek word fantasia is the word for imagination. It's the Greek word for imagination. So, you know, we know what imagination is. We just create, you know, we even talk about fantasy literature, imaginative literature, right? The mind creates all these things. And fear is a great producer of these things. I'm going to create them like faster than any, like, you know, production line could ever produce. I don't know, bubble gum or something. Your mind will, a fearful mind will create fantasies like a mile a minute. This could happen, this could happen, this could happen. And then you're like just, you're in control of these things. And then here's the crazy thing that St. John Chrysostom says, right? When this happens, this terrible irony happens because something that isn't even real, that's the very definition of a fantasy. It ain't real. That's a fantasy. That's the definition. Not real. But something that's not even real, that you've generated out of your fear, now has more power over you than the God who we say at the end of every service, who is, in some translations, the existing one, or simply he who is. If you look at any icon of Christ in the past 1,000 years, it's right in the halo, the cross. Ho-on. You know this. It's the Greek name for God. He who is. Right? Christ doesn't just exist. He doesn't have being like this table. God is the source of being. He doesn't have being. He is being, we might say. But he's the really real. That's why I sometimes tell people I want to emphasize it. He's the really real. Right? But a fantasy that produces an imagination and a fear and a projection that's not even real can now have a lot more power over me than the really real God. That's what fear does. That's what fear does. Chrysostom says, this is probably on your sheet, it's a short quote though, from letter 9. You surround yourself with grievous thoughts. The Greek word is logis mus. It's a logis me. You've all heard that term, logis me, thoughts. You surround yourself with grievous thoughts, even inventing things which do not exist, lacerating yourself in vain for no purpose whatsoever, with great harm to yourself. Right? So this is what happens. Fear produces these kind of things because we're afraid. I've got to be in control of all this. And what happens if I'm not in control? When our focus is external on all these things around me and trying to keep it all in control, which I can't control, all this stuff happens. So we have to just focus on what we can control, which in the grand scheme of the whole cosmos, it's not very much. Like I said, I don't want to repeat myself. You can't control your parishioners. You can't control your husband.
Oh, wait a second.
You think you can. You can't control your kids. You can't control your kids. Really? Right? You can't control whether you get cancer. You can't control, you know, trade relations with China. Okay. Can't control the Tao, right? There's a little that we can control. And when we make that the recipe, we're just in trouble. We're just setting ourselves up for all these, for despondency, ultimately. Because it's all going to fall. And we say, what did I do all this for? Right? So to control, to say, what can I actually control? This is what Kristen's trying to say to Olympias. What can you really control? Very little. But here's the thing. But what you can control is what really, really matters. Because let's just say, I mean, just in some sort of complete hypothetical world, God gave you control of your husband or your children or your parish. I mean, real control. What would you do with it? Well, I know what I do. I mean, I mess with things very quick because I'm filled with passions and I'm filled with all sorts of, you know, misaligned loves and desires, etc., etc. And bad things would happen in very short order. I mean, there's science fiction books about this kind of thing. Someone sort of suddenly getting all this godlike power and what happens as a result. It's not good. It's not good. So to focus on the little, maybe seemingly the little thing, my soul, right? What I can do with it. What can I do in this situation, right? What can I do? Bad things are happening. What do? I keep the commandment of Christ, right? Just as a sort of like, what? Because this is where my salvation will be found. This is where my salvation will be found. Right? And I have forgotten. 1 second. So, and I don't have this in the notes, but let me say this because as I'm saying it out loud, I'm thinking, here's what this sounds like. This sounds really almost narcissistic. I just have to focus on myself. And we hear this in our culture all the time, in a lot of psychology, and sometimes that's helpful if you're in. People talk about like toxic relationships, you got to get out of those. Okay, sometimes you do have to, there's no question. But what I'm not saying is, I don't want you to hear me saying this. Just focus on yourself. Right? Don't worry about anybody else. Don't even worry about your kids. Of course you're. Because if you're keeping the commandment of Christ, you're going to love God and love your neighbor. You're going to serve, you're going to be merciful, you're going to care for the poor. Right? You're going to give the homeless guy a sandwich. But you're not necessarily going to make it your life's work to get him sober and get him in a home and get him a job. I mean, you might have to do that. But I live in Arkansas. Even just the number of homeless people I meet on a regular basis, I can't do that for all of them. I give them a sandwich. Give them $5. I can't do much more than that. Right? So I'm not saying, no. Sorry, homeless guy. I'm working on my salvation. That's not what it's not narcissism. Egocentric narcissism, selfishness. Because that has nothing to do with the commandments of Christ. The commandment of Christ is love God, love your neighbor. It's focusing outside myself. So this is very tricky. Right? This is very, very tricky. The commandment of Christ focuses me outside of myself. Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. I mean, those are the two great commandments, and Jesus says they sum up all the others. So that seems like a sort of an external focus. Right? But while we're doing that, it's love God with all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. Not control God with all your oomph and control everybody else with all your oomph, oomph, oomph. And that's the very subtle difference. Right? And when we lose sight of that, and we do this all the time, forgive me, I've gone from preaching to meddling here. You're just going to have to get mad at me, I guess, if you want to. That's fine. It's very easy for people to do, to turn love into manipulation. Wanting to control. It's not love, it's fear. That's always fear. Right? Okay.
Well, I'll try to regurgitate my thoughts here, but I guess what you were talking about with fear and phantasma or
fantasy,
being just the opposite of God's existing, like,
right.
You know, is existence, reminded me of this insane, weird fear that started the first time I saw Niagara Falls. Mm-hmm. And I had three kids in strollers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. My husband was here, maybe I can blame it on him, but we let one out of the strollers, and they were walking around, and you know, and they weren't even anywhere near close to falling in the water, but there's definitely portions where there's no fencing, or it's just the rushing water going, you know.
Right.
And ever since then, I just had this insane, like, I've had nightmares about it. I've been just day mirrors about, you know, we're just like, God, what would I do if one of my kids jumped in the water? And so I built all these different, like, hypothetical scenarios and I had to deal with this thing that never happened, that doesn't exist, about a thing that does exist. And so I know that my fear, like, is somehow enmeshed with love, like, because I love my children.
Right.
And so I fear for them or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I know that fear can have to do with love, but then we, like, I've created, like, very physical, this very, like, real reaction to something that's not real.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think there's, in some ways, like, that it can be confusing and difficult to try to discern what the fear is rooted in, what is a real, you know, like, these cycles of, like, actually, like, sort of manifesting something unreal in your real reactions to, and this making this big snowball, like, well, my decision is I'm just never going to Buffalo, or, you know, kind of outlandish.
That's probably not a bad idea. This is a guy who's never gone to Buffalo.
I think I saw some articles saying that Buffalo, the pizza capital of the U.S. now, yesterday, so maybe that might be a reason.
That could be a game changer, yeah.
You know, but you see, I don't know if that was confusing, but you see where I'm
going. Well, yeah, I mean, it is, it's, of course it's, I mean, the tricky thing is, like I said, it's not really just simple. If it was simple, we would just take, and I almost didn't tell the Chinese farmer story because I really don't like it. It's a Buddhist proverb, actually, just love cow bag. And what I don't like about it is, maybe not, we'll see, it almost breeds that sort of, like, stoicism. Stoicism is a bad word, but the way stoicism is not even bad, but the way we use it means it's just sort of almost like cold, you know, without affection. And that's not what we're called to. We're not called to not love our children, for example. Obviously. I mean, it seems obvious. But sometimes we read the spiritual fathers and the writings, it seems like we're almost being, this is being advocated, and it's not. But the fact that we do love, and we are to love, makes it messy because we're really not in control, and we really don't have a whole lot of control. I think that's really what Kristen is trying to tell Olympias. And I'll say a little bit more about it later, but basically he talks a lot about how we have to be very rational. And it's funny because, you know, as I said kind of last night, we Orthodox, we love to sort of say things like Orthodoxy is mystical and the West is rational. That's nothing that would stand up to scrutiny reading one father for three pages of one book or something. Because the fathers are all about being rational. Not rationalism, but just clear thinking. Right? Let's be rational about this. And Kristen's always telling Olympias this because she's despondent and she's hopeless and she lost all this. And he's just saying we need to be rational. So that's really the first step. And we just sort of have to check ourselves. When we find ourselves sort of fantasizing, not good fantasies, bad fantasies, fears. This could happen. We have to check ourselves and just say, is this realistic? It's not realistic. Move on. You know? And it's, you can only do it as soon as you become conscious of it. So something that we struggle with for a long time, we can sort of unconsciously be thinking about something. We're not conscious that we're thinking it. That sounds like a paradox, thinking something unconsciously. But we know, if we're alive and we're human, we have all sorts of thoughts going through our head that we're not sort of seeing that we're thinking it. But as soon as I see myself thinking this thought, does that make sense?
Yeah.
As soon as I see the fear, like, oh, I'm thinking about my child falling off Niagara Falls, this isn't rational. I'm not near Niagara Falls.
Become more about fear and not love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Also about not being in control, like something like that, you have no control. It's almost like having a dream that your child falls over and you have no control over.
No, I think
you
exactly.
Like all these scenarios are going in your mind, like, what can I do?
Your right. Points more to me.
Yeah, so it's almost like turning our will over to God and said, you know, we are going to be in situations that we have no control. When you send your kids to school or when you do situations like that, we have no control over them. They're not right there, we can't discipline them, we can't. Well, all of us have to let go. It's almost like the letting go of situations we can't control, which is everything in life.
almost everything in life. And the more we work on that, what happens is, just like I said last night, virtues lead to more virtues, right? So if we learn to deal with our thoughts even in one small area, I mean, let's just use, I know you guys think all I care about is fasting, but that's just the example I go to all the time, because fasting is pretty, I don't like to talk about, like, you know, sexual sins and stuff. That's also like, so I just like to talk about fasting because people aren't really that anxious about food, right? But we're taught to fast. But here's just an example of how one thing leads to another in a good way. It's a fast day. You know, it's a fast day. Now, if you're a pregnant nursing, I know you're not fasting. So, but even, you know, you've got your own spiritual fathers. I'm not trying to be your spiritual father. But, you know, so like I have, you know, nursing or pregnant mothers coming to me, or elderly people who, you know, can't fast. And they'll say, you know, I would like to be able to fast, but I can't. I say, well, you can still keep the fast, but then you have to have milk, but you don't have to have a milkshake. Mm-hmm. Right. You get some protein, but you don't have to have a double cheeseburger with fries. Right? Right? And we all know that. We all know that. I mean, that's just common sense. It doesn't have to be all or nothing. Like, well, I'm not fasting, so here I go. Right? So even if you're fasting in that more limited way, you know that the biggest part of fasting, we all know this if we're honest, the biggest part of fasting isn't the eating, it's the thoughts that, you know, that are attacking. It's like, I'd sure love to have a hamburger right now. I mean, lunch was great. It's like, what? Could I have pizza? I mean, you know, I really love pizza. And you mentioned pizza in Buffalo. I mean, I'm already thinking about pizza. But, you know, to the degree that I just let myself continue to think that, it's a problem. So the fasting isn't just the not eating. And it's not even really what I gain from fasting. It's not shedding calories or not taking calories. That's just very... Because probably the fasting, the Lenten, you might just have as many calories and carbs and all this other stuff. But it's the discipline of just learning not to think about that thing. Because the more I think about it, the more power it's got over me. So if I learn just in a small thing like fasting, it's Wednesday I get up. I'll just tell you my routine. Every day, except on a liturgy or fast day, I get up after my prayers. I have coffee. I have Faye yogurt with honey and granola. Right? Sound like one of those guys, like, yeah, that's me. But that's what I have every day. So I get up on a fast day, and it's like I can't have that. And I can start, like, in my mind saying, but why not? I can start dallying with the thought. Or I can just say, I'm having oatmeal today, and move on. And if I do that, it's all over very quickly. Right? It's just over very quickly. I'm just having this oatmeal day. Boom. It's not complicated. But the more I think about it, the more I fantasize, and that's what I'm doing. Let's just be honest. I'm fantasizing about yogurt. How small is my life? I'm fantasizing about yogurt. First world problems, right? This is what we were talking about. But you know, see, the more I begin, the more we know that the longer I think about it, the more powerful it grows. And this isn't even like a big sin. This is just yogurt. But see, here's my point. If I can just in that small thing, which is almost inconsequential. Almost inconsequential, yogurt or oatmeal. Almost inconsequential. But if even in that little area, I can just say, oatmeal. Next thing that needs to be done. Move on. Then I've started to gain a battle in my mind and how to deal with thoughts. And that then transfers into things like fears about my children. In a way that we might not be able to see it until we've learned it. I said this again last night, so forgive me for repeating myself, but I tell people this confession all the time. Just try to fast more strictly. And look at me. I'm not like Chrysostom and Olympias who, you know, shriveled themselves up through excessive fasting. I'm not that guy, right? But I'm just saying, you know, but if you can't say no to whatever, it doesn't have to be a cheeseburger, it doesn't have to be yogurt, whatever it is for you. We've all got things that comfort us, right? And if we just can't say no to a little something, even though if it seems very inconsequential, how am I going to say no to those fears that just want to dominate me? Things are not even real that suddenly have more reality for me than the living God, right? So I think we start small, right? Start small, see every little thing as a sort of an ascetic thing, right? A fast day, reading the scriptures, saying your prayers. Every one of Christ's commandments works this way. I can keep the commandment or not. But if I do it, I'm strengthened in my mind, my soul, etc. And that's really what the virtues, not to go back to the virtues, but that's really what they do. I mean, the virtues fortify us. They're strong. That's why in Latin, as I said, the word is the same word for vir, man. they're strong. The virtues are strong. And we think the passions are strong because we experience them. Yeah. But really, virtues are much, much stronger. So I don't want to belabor that. Any other questions before we move on? Yeah.
Can you, I know this is a huge question, I'm going to ask you to unpack very quickly. So when you say despondency, mm-hmm. I'm trying to clarify, you mean like epithia? Like
this? Yes.
Okay, thank you, that helps. Greek. Can you distinguish a little bit between that and clinical depression?
Probably not.
But I'm thinking about just when you're talking about intentionality and rationality, mm-hmm. because it's something that we all know somebody, if we ourselves have not struggled with mental illness, somebody in our parish does.
Yes, absolutely.
And to be able to distinguish, how does someone who's suffering from something like clinical anxiety, which is different from, it's a wiring thing, or clinical depression, what is some way they can use this acquisition of the virtues to avoid that further spiritual despondency when you are already dealing with that heaviness? What would that look like?
Well, I mean, I don't know what it would look like. All I can say very generally, and it's very, very general, but just to keep the commandments to the in their life, because this is always specific to each individual person.
To the degree
to which they're able. Right? If a person, for example, clinical anxiety, and if I just say to them, Jesus says, don't worry about tomorrow. Tomorrow will take care of itself. I might just be beating them down.
Yeah.
Right? So that's not going to be super helpful. But I can find other ways, less sort of in their face, to give them maybe a word. I'm talking about as their priest, not as their, their neighbor or their garbage man. But I mean, someone who doesn't know them, just walk up off the street and say, hey, you got problems with anxiety here. But I'm saying like as their priest or maybe, Presbyter Montes, because someone is close to someone like this in the parish. Because people can feel hopeless, and this is really the root of, of akadia, hopelessness, despair, that they just are like, well, I can't be changed, it doesn't matter. Well, I mean, even there, I would say, and this is really hard in our culture because even secular-wise, we're all trying to grow. I'm growing. People say this all the time. I'm growing. Am I growing spiritually? And I really just tell people, and like in my church, in confession, quit worrying about whether you're growing or not. That's pretty narcissistic, honestly. So getting their attention off of that, keep the commandments, love God the best you can, right? There's an old medieval, late medieval, it doesn't really matter, Catholic expression. Father Hofke said all the time, pray as you can, not as you can't. But I tell people that applies to every area of the spiritual life. Do as you can, not as you can. Don't, the Russians have a proverb, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And forgive me, you can just all throw stones at me. I think women especially have to hear this. Don't be throwing stones at me. I just hear a lot of confessions, and a lot of women are really just beat down by the guilt of the things they haven't accomplished and what's happened with their kids, and there's just this guilt. And it's all this, the perfect being the enemy of the good. And I think with people with clinical depression, clinical anxiety, and I'm not any sort of psychologist, so I'm trying to just tread very carefully here. They, first of all, should probably be seeing professional help, of course. That goes all without saying, right? That all goes without saying, but maybe it should be said. They need to be getting help, right? But they're still going to come to church, and they're still going to talk to you and other people about their problems, and you can't just say, go talk to your counselor, I don't know. I mean, even as a priest, I hear confessions of people who are seeing counselors. I can tell you, it's very tricky. I have to, keep in the back of my head what to say, what not to say. I've learned from, experience, some things just are not helpful, some things are. But I think that this is very, very important. Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, and help people realize the spiritual life is just this daily, gentle, sometimes it doesn't seem gentle, just walking toward Christ, keeping the commandments, and not letting this imagination, this fantasy, either of, bad, terrible things that are going to swamp me, that happens a lot, but also people can get grandiose. I'm going to attain theosis in 5 easy steps in 3 weeks or something like that. I don't think so.
I was just hoping, I can't say it the way I want to say it. It's not going to be right, but But can you just reiterate for like a situation where our kids are in danger that we still, you said we should be rational, you know, but I know you were focusing more on like the internal thoughts that get out
right.
of hand.
Right.
But could you just clarify that we still like?
Yeah, we're still human. We're still normal parents. So I don't let my daughter, my 16-year-old daughter, go to somebody's house who I don't know. That's not me. I mean, I guess you say I'm acting out of fear, but that's very rational, right? She's a 16-year-old daughter. There are men who want to prey on her.
Right.
See, look how I'm tightening up even as I say this. I mean, I almost made a fist. I will just, this is like confession time. There was a 20-something or 30-something-year-old guy flirting with my daughter in the grocery store one day, and I heard about it after the fact, and I started to go get in the car and drive to that grocery store and find him. And probably lose my priesthood beating this guy to a pulp. And my daughter and wife said, sit down, stop. So I'm not saying I practice all of this, right? And that was more anger than fear because it was all over. You can hear that I'm still tense just talking about it now. So I've got a 16-year-old daughter, right? And I've had kids. Yeah, I'm not advocating carelessness, laissez-faire parenting. Let them do whatever they want. Don't let those things control you. No. And it's the same way to parish. I'm still the priest. I'm not advocating, you guys do whatever you want. You want to do Christmas liturgy or Basil's liturgy today? Not liturgy, just want to play poker and smoke cigars on Friday. No, I'm the priest. This is what we're doing. Right? It's not just because I'm a priest. But no, I'm not advocating that we alleviate ourselves of the things that we have responsibility for. Because again, the commandment of Christ is love. Right? The commandment of Christ is love God, love your neighbor. That means I fulfill all my responsibilities to the world. I mean, to my wife, to my children, to my parishioners, etc. I'm not advocating that we don't do those things. But it is very, very tricky finding the line between that and being controlled by fear and trying to control everything. It's very hard to find it. It's very hard to find. I had someone come to me a while back and we were talking and she was saying that she struggles with, you know, the basic stuff, anxiety and wanting to, basically she was saying all this stuff, I want to be in control. And, I mean, she didn't say all this, she said all the things that led me to say, your problem is you want to be in control, right? She didn't say it quite that way. She's like, I'm anxious, I'm fearful, and I'm depressed. These, you know, blah, blah, blah. Not clinically, but just, she, you know, periods of downness because things aren't going the way she wanted in her life, in her marriage, with her kids, with her job. All sorts of things. The kind of things that happen all the time. Right? And I basically told her this stuff that I'm telling you, you know. You're not really in control very much, and you better come to terms with that. And the sooner you come to terms with it, the better off you'll be. So we said all this, I felt like she got it. She said, okay, is it okay if I still have goals? That sounds kind of innocuous. Goals? Yeah, I have some goals, right? But what she was saying was, can I still hang on? Please. And again, I'm not certainly no holy elder, I'm not a psychologist. But I just said honestly. Obviously, I mean, you have to keep a bank account. You have to do these things. I said, but, you know, these are things that have been really hurting you. Do you really not? And here's the analogy I used. I said, if you went to, if you knew someone, that might be me, no, I'm not airplane mode. Shouldn't be me. Doesn't matter. I said, if you knew someone was an alcoholic, and they said, I just want to have one. I mean, ask anybody in any 12 in Alcoholics Anonymous. Can you just have one more drink? And every alcoholic will say, there's no such thing as one more drink. There's 20,000 more drinks, but there's no such thing. Anybody that's gone through recovery really will tell you that there's no such thing as one more drink. So when someone says, can I just have goals? And forgive me, maybe I'm wrong, but that's what I got in my head. Can I just have one more drink? So, I mean, that's a hard word. I realize that. And I'm not saying throw your planner out and, you know, we all have to live, you know. My washer's broken. When I get home, it's got to be fixed. I can't say, no, I don't have any cares. Right? There's a great story in the Desert Fathers about Abijam the dwarf. And he went to the desert with his brother. And they took up residence in this cell. You've probably heard the story. And after a while, Abijam decided he'd attained to such spiritual heights that he was going to become like the angels. Right? Free of care. Like, he probably wouldn't even need to eat anymore because he was getting so spiritual, he probably wouldn't even need to eat anymore. So his brother's going out, you know, and he's a monk and he's saying his prayers all night and he goes out and works all day. And one day, John's not working. He says, "What are you doing?" He says, "I've become like the angels." And his brother says, "Well, you ain't gonna do it around here. You don't work, you don't eat." But John says, "Well, I'm a spiritual man now." So his brother says, "Fine, see ya. But you're not gonna live here and, you know, mush off me, you know." We think these people aren't human. So John goes out to live like the angels in the desert. And like 3 days later, he's back at the door. "Who is it?" "It's your brother John." "I don't have a brother John. He's an angel now." "Who is it?" "It's your brother John. I'm hungry." "Well, if you want to live here and eat, you got to work." "I'll work." Right? So, I'm not advocating sort of angelic carefreeness. Right, I'm not advocating that. We live in the world, we've got spouses, we've got kids, we've got parishioners, missions and missioners. Mm-hmm. Oh, those things all have to be done. Right, but it's really about my internal, am I operating out of fear or out of love? Right? And without digressing any further, I would say that really what's essential to this, and I'm a real hypocrite saying this, is prayer. We really have to learn to just pray. Doesn't have to, again, this is one of those things. I say this to people, and immediately it's like, yeah, I can pray because they're letting the enemy be the perfect be the enemy of the good. People tell me all the time in confession, "I quit praying because I couldn't pray like I thought I was supposed to." And I just tell them, I'm just very honest, that's just the devil you're listening to. The devil's a terrible spiritual father. Right? So don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Pray as you can, not as you can't, right? All this kind of stuff. Any other questions? We're just halfway there, so let's keep moving. So do we need a break? Please say no.
15 minutes?
Okay, 15 minutes, good. All right. So this is where we get to the really important thing. So, you know, I don't want to recap. We've been recapping. So based upon everything I've said, right, I don't want to recap, but you have to sort of have in your mind everything I've said. Inward focus, love, keeping the commandments, not outward focus, based on fear and trying to control everything, because if my focus is on the external and what I have to be in control of to keep it all together, despondency will just ensue, right? So, when we consider all the above, we discover profound truth, as St. John states this way, and I said it in my introduction, no one can harm the man who does not injure himself. Forgive me, I know that's sexist language. But no one can harm the person. That just doesn't come out quite so well. Who does not harm him or herself. So here's St. John himself, and this isn't in the letters to Olympias. He wrote the letters to Olympias in exile, to Olympias, but he also wrote two larger works. One of them is called On the Providence of God. I didn't bring it with me, but there's a new translation out of that. And the other one is this book, which I mentioned in my intro, No One Can Harm the Man Who Does Not Injure Himself, and that you can find online for free. And he says this, I'm just going to read a paragraph of this. Thus, in no case, sorry, this is like 19th century translation, it ain't the best. Thus, in no case will anyone be able to injure a man who does not choose to injure himself. But if a man is not willing to be temperate and to aid himself from his own resources, no one will ever be able to profit him. For it is not stress of circumstances, nor variation of seasons, nor insults of men in power, nor intrigues besetting you like snowstorms, John was a rhetorician, nor a crowd of calamities, nor a promiscuous collection of all the ills to which mankind is subject, which can disturb even slightly. These things cannot even slightly disturb the man who is brave, temperate, and watchful. Right? All these terrible things cannot disturb the person who is brave, temperate, and watchful. Just as on the contrary, the indolent and supine man who is his own betrayer cannot be made better even with the aid of innumerable ministrations. I wish someone would translate this to a more modern English. But basically saying, the person who's virtuous, this is what he's saying in a nutshell. The virtuous person, the truly virtuous person who's kept the commandments of Christ and their soul has been fortified through these commandments, and they become virtuous, they become brave, they become loving, they become merciful, they become passionate, they become peaceful, sober. No matter what happens, it's not going to hurt them. Right? And the person, likewise, or on the opposite, not likewise, who is a wreck internally, they can go to every monastery, visit every holy elder, get every Abba, give me a word, and get a million words. Memorize the Bible. Be raised from the dead. I don't know. Literally, I mean, really, it could be Lazarus. But if in here, it's all disordered through fear and all this other stuff, it won't amount to anything. It just really won't amount to anything. St. John gives numerous biblical examples of this. You can read the writings. He talks about the three holy ewes in the furnace. I mean, you know, again, think of a Chinese farmer. This happens. Oh, that's terrible. Maybe, maybe not. They threw the three, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, into the furnace. That's terrible. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you know who they're going to be in there with them? Right? I mean, you've heard the story. Joseph is sold into slavery. This is probably the great, I love that we read this in Lent. Just as we're getting ready for Holy Week, we read the story of Joseph because he's a type of Christ. But this story is, the story of Joseph, you're all familiar with it. It's so remarkable. Sold by his brothers, into slavery, sold into Egypt. All these bad things happen. I mean, it's just like the Chinese farmer story, right? Thrown into prison. That's terrible. Maybe, maybe not. He starts interpreting dreams and then becomes the second to Pharaoh. That's right. Maybe, maybe not. I mean, you know, he's close to Pharaoh. And then, you know the whole story. It's kind of like this. But see, here's St. John's example when he talks about Joseph. Joseph is like this to all that. I mean, the circumstances are all this. They're just all up and down, all over the place. He's sold into slavery. He gets to Egypt and he becomes, you know, Potiphar's cupbearer, whatever. Not cupbearer, but something like that. So he's elevated. But then the wife tries to seduce him and he won't give in. And his whole life is like this. But the whole time, this is the external circumstances. Joseph is like this. Because no one can injure the man who does not harm himself. Right? So, Kristen gives other examples. Paul's persecution in the early church. And we have, remarkably, St. John's example himself. And if you read these letters to Olympias, it's not all just sort of preachy, preachy, preachy. Some of it's very personal. He wasn't naive. He was aware of the difficulties facing him and his fellow believers. In one paragraph, he'll be writing to her saying, you know, do not despair. Despair is bad, and don't give in to fear and all these things that I've been talking about. And the next paragraph will be saying, my health is terrible. I'm sick as a dog. I mean, this is the new King John translation, not King John. Dr. David Ford did a great translation. This new edition is really wonderful. You should buy it. But he says this in effect, right? I'm sick as a dog, and I'm in here, and they won't ventilate the place. So it's just smoke, and I can't eat. And it almost sounds like complaining. So, you know, you have to read the letters to see that, you know, he's pretty human too. He's not just saying, rise above and conquer everything. And then, you know, yeah, those are it. Yeah, they have them at the bookstore. Very good. So, he discusses, you know, these difficult situations of his health. He writes letters counseling the clergy and faithful how to act in their current situation. So he's not just saying, I've become like an angel, right, St. John. He's even from exile, he's writing these letters saying, tell so-and-so to do this, tell so-and-so to do this. He's still being a priest. He's still being a spiritual father. He's critical of the bishops and the clergy that were, you know, were doing wrong. But in all of this, his focus is on salvation. Really, that's all he's concerned about. His salvation, Olympias' salvation, getting out of despondency, right? Getting back to life, you know, the life of keeping the commandments, etc. So this he says in letter 10, this is probably on your handout. This is what we are hastening to do, not only to banish your despondency, but to fill you with great and continual gladness. This is possible if you are willing. This is always the question, isn't it? I ask people this in confessional a lot. No, I don't want this, or they don't say that, they don't want to say, I'm struggling with this, I'm struggling with this, I'm struggling to forgive so-and-so, and I'll just ask them, do you want to forgive so-and-so? And sometimes they'll just be honest, and they'll even, like, look at me, no, they look almost like the Gollum look. No. You know the Gollum look you've also seen, yeah. It's like, well, that's why you're struggling to forgive me, because you don't want to. I mean, the first step is being willing. And like I said last night, sometimes people say, I don't even feel like I'm able to repent. But I say, but do you want to repent? I don't know if I even want to repent. Do you want to repent? I want to repent. Then you've got the will. But if the person says, no, I don't even want to repent. Well, like Kristen, there's nothing I can do for you. Right? There's another story in the Desert Fathers, but I'm going to mess it all up. But these disciples come to an Abba and say, Abba, what is it? Something about forgiving someone. And the Abba says, well, forgive them from the heart. And they say, we can't do that. And he says, okay, well, at least, I don't remember what the next level was, at least, forgive me, I wasn't prepared. This should be on the tip of my tongue. Anyway, he works down from like forgiving them to just even being willing to forgive them. And they say, well, we're not even willing to do that, finally. And he says, he calls to the steward, he says, get these invalids some soup. They can't even, you know, they're in really bad shape. Mm-hmm. Right? Bring these guys some soup. Like, you know, they can't even eat meat. Right? They're really that sick. So just the willingness is, it really just starts here. We have to be honest with ourselves about that. So this is possible if you are willing, for the immutable laws of nature do not make it impossible for us to force ourselves to make a change. Rather, the power to manage your own welfare lies easily in the free decision of your will. And in this, our joy resides. Again, in this, our joy resides. Not on the things that are happening outside, because if my joy is based upon what's happening outside of me, I got news for you. It's never going to be a good story. Because it'd be joyous for 5 minutes and despondent for 20, and then joyous for 3. And, you know, it's always changing. But Christum says our joy resides in this and in what's inside. And all of this because it is not the nature of things. He's talking about external things. It's not in the nature of things, our circumstances, but in the will of man that joy is found. For I will not cease chanting this refrain continually. Take advantage of our excellent assistance. He's talking about his letters to her. Take advantage of our excellent assistance so that we may set you completely free from the bitter bondage of your thoughts. Again, it's the word logis me. If you are not willing to be zealous in this as much as we are, there's nothing else we can do for your healing. So, let's sum this up, and then this is a good stopping point before the last talk. If no one can injure the man who does not harm himself, how do we harm ourselves? Well, by forgetting what is basically a logical spiritual truth already outlined. God's providence, leading to our faith in Him, giving our attention and focus on what we can actually control on ourselves, an inner versus an outer focus, acquisition of virtue, rather than becoming fearful and disturbed over external circumstances. And if we grasp this, and this is also, really, this is also very simple. It's not really that profound. But when I read this 27 years ago, before I was even Orthodox the first time, no one can injure the man who's not harm himself. And I read Christmas and I said, oh, that's what I mean. It's like the light bulb went on. And I wish I would have lived it every day since, because I don't, unfortunately. But this is really rather profound. Because if you don't understand this, you are perpetually a slave to everything and everyone outside of you that you care about or that you fear. You might not care, you might hate them. You're a slave to everybody you hate. I got news for you. Everybody you loathe, you've made yourself a slave to them. We think hatred sets us free. It doesn't set us free, does it? I mean, it just ties us to a person. So if we grasp this simple but profound truth, we see almost miraculously that every situation and circumstance in life becomes an opportunity for us to keep the commandments, to acquire the virtues, and to be saved. And we could go through countless stories, the lives of saints, and you might say, well, you know, I know priests and monarchs and priests' wives and clergy wives can be the most cynical of people. I understand that. But think of someone, you know, this isn't from 1500 years ago, some far off, you know, think of someone like St. Nikolai Velimirovich, great 20th century Serbian saint, who was thrown into Dachau during World War II by the Nazis. And someone years later said, what did you do in Dachau? And he said, well, you'd sit in a little corner, on a pile of rags, a little dirty corner. And he said, and you would pray. And of course, he's talking about his own spiritual experience, right? But he's talking about almost like, that's what everybody did, but and maybe, but he says, you would sit in a little corner, and you'd pray. And you'd just say, I'm dust and ashes. Lord, I'm dust and ashes. Right? I'm nothing. And he says, and then he says, and he's sitting in Dachau, and he says, then you would be caught up, and you'd see the face of God. He's describing the highest stage of spiritual life happening in the corner of Dachau. Then you'd be caught up into heaven, and you'd see the face of Christ. Until you couldn't take it anymore, and you'd say, Lord, send me back down, send me back down. And then you get back down and you say, Lord, I'm dust and ashes. I'm dust. It's like the Jesus parables, right? I'm dust and ashes. So where is it not possible to keep the commandments? And this is one of the things Father Sofroni says. It's always possible to keep the commandments. And we're always, again, we're always sort of looking for that scene. Yeah, but. No, it's always possible to keep the commandments. Because the commandment is what? Humility. It's always possible to be humble. The commandment is mercy. The commandment is love. Right? You know, I mean, I don't even have to tell the story, and I know we need to take a break. But you all know, probably, no doubt, Father Roman says in his book, I just bought a second copy this morning because I'm always loaning it out, so I'll disappear. So I bought another copy of his, that book-length interview with him. If you haven't read it, you absolutely should. Exploring the Inner Universe. There's only four copies left in there. They publish it. The monastery does. But you know, he talks about, you know where he learned to pray? I know some of you know where he learned to pray. I don't mean to say to our Father, to say, but you know where he learned to pray? Solitary confinement, right? So that when they came to take him out, he didn't want to go. He'd found heaven in a communist solitary confinement. The gate of heaven is everywhere. Right? The gate of heaven is everywhere. So, if we can see that, right, then there's no external circumstance where we say, yeah, well, I can't pray here. There's nothing that happens then in my life that I say, well, I can't be saved with this God. I'm sorry. Right? It's all internal. It's all the turn of my heart and my will. Do I want to be saved? Then I can be saved here. Okay. So, all right, this is a good time for a break.